Blog Talk Radio.
What's happening? And tonight is Tuesday, June the 29th. And tonight we are saying the original sin in America was slavery. The second sin is the attempt to keep the former slaves in economic and political ignorance. And we want to remind you that this evening we will be concluding our 2021 fall program. We will start up again in September, the second week of September, and we sincerely hope that we'll be able to round up the usual suspects. So, without further ado, Ralph Pointer, what's happening?
My brothers and sisters, thank you so much for tuning in on this very hot summer day. I hope everyone is in air condition or in a circumstance where it is not too painful to stop and listen to a program. Now, our program states, the original sin in America was slavery. The second sin is the attempt to keep us in economic and political ignorance. Well, that's only partially true. What's really true is the original sin in America was the genocide of the indigenous people here, formerly known as Indians, and I'm going to paraphrase that wonderful song, America Beautiful, the Beautiful, from sea to shining sea. A terrible thing has been done, but as I said before, it possibly could be a human weakness that we state our own issue, almost ignoring the other issues. We have to remember that genocide has been going on a long time. Do we know about King Leopold in the Congo? Mark Twain tried to tell us about it. Do we know about Armenians? Do we know about Palestinians? Or do we know about what Che Guevara, the great Che Guevara, told us? It is important that everybody struggles on their own issue at the same time against the same monster. And so we must have that in mind. And now I'm going to get back to our issue, in case we're not on Zoom, people do not know that I am a gentleman of color. And this evening, as of last week, we talk about the black community being terrorized. And I'm going to follow up on that. We're being terrorized, and the Floyd case shows it, and the young woman who took the pictures said she lays awake at night because she felt she could have done more. She did more than anyone else. And if it was just Floyd, it would be bad enough. But it's happening all over the country all of the time, forever. And we forget the basic tenet of life. We ignore it. And I wonder why we continue to ignore it. Now, this is one of the ways we ignore it. The basic tenet of all life is self-defense. Plants develop self-defense. Flowers develop self-defense. Everything develops self-defense. And here we are, a people who have been oppressed since Europe hit Africa, and probably before, because I look at the conduct of some of the kings in Africa, and I wonder what was going on there. But all of that being said, we can do nothing about that history. We can make our own history if and when we understand. As many of you on the program teach in colleges, universities, public schools, and as Sister Betty tells us, if you can't read your world, and briefly I say, if you don't know where you are, you're in big trouble, and we don't know where we are. One of the things that struck me this evening, I'm watching the public broadcast news on Channel 13, and they're talking about all of the Congress folks of color live in fear. They get phone calls. Some talk about they're going to quit. They can't take it. Some talk about they act in a certain way, speak in a monotone, so as not to upset anyone. How do we get to that point when you can get to the governing bodies of this country and you're still not free? We're still fighting the same battle over and over again, the battle for the right to vote. When I looked at this program, I saw people who were traveling through a dangerous part of the route to come into America through Colombia and Panama, and I noticed all black people, the young woman and gentleman who did that, young white journalist, a pair of journalists, and they got the Peabody Award, the Pulitzer Prize for their story. But the story I got is black people from around the world are running, looking for freedom, looking for, as I say, personal freedom. And guess personal freedom comes first. But then where does that leave personal sacrifice? We have political prisoners in America. Those who sacrifice their lives, the lives of their families, the lives of many in their community for justice. And I've only heard two of our representatives in this so-called government or so-called representatives in the government speak of political prisoners. Cynthia McKinney, a congressperson from Georgia, and Charles Barron, a political activist, a thorn in the side of the Democratic, racist Democratic Party in New York, speak constantly of political prisoners. My friends, my brothers and sisters, we have been bamboozled, as Malcolm X told us. We don't know up from down. They tell us who to hate today, and we hate them, and then tomorrow they say you got to love them, and then we love them, and then the next day they say you got to hate them, and then finally they say you got to hate yourself. You're not up to it. You're not worth it. You're not quite citizen. You don't have human qualities. We're not going to treat you like human, and we're not angry. We have to do something about that. I watched a young woman from Howard say that she was in journalism, but she changed to do something to help people. She's going to go into social work. And I'm saying, gee, we all quote the Bible. You know, and the Bible tells us, and I'm not a theist, mind you, never was a theist, but we quote the Bible that says you don't teach, you don't help a person to talk to them about their poverty, their circumstances. You teach them to work. You teach you don't give them fish. You teach a fisherman to fish. You teach a baker to bake bread. You teach a farmer to farm. And so what is our job? The job has been stated over and over again. Teach, teach, teach. And what you have to do before you teach is learn, learn, learn. Where are we? What is America all about? It is about oppression of people here and around the world. And I'm not going to go into what my father taught me many, many years ago. And if somebody hates you, not because of anything you did to them, not because of what you represent, just because they got hate in their hearts, don't try to be their friend until you beat them. And when you beat them, then they'll come to be your friend. And so we must say, how do we beat them? What is our role here today? Well, this is a program of political prisoners. We're trying to bring humanity. We always talk about human rights, human rights, human rights, and then we act inhuman. We act like we have no humanity. What type of humanity is it that sees someone, see people sacrifice their lives for us, and we ignore them? That's who we are. We ignore political prisoners. They sacrifice, and too bad. Well, let's start becoming human. Let's start becoming educated. Let us learn political power. We have all of these people in Congress and no political power at all, and how in the hell did we get the drug laws that put half of our youth into the death camp? And there's no greater example of that is when the fentanyl hit the white community, when the oxycodone hit the white community. They didn't put them in jail. What they did is gave them medical treatment, advice, cultural advice, jobs. They put us in jail. What must be said for people to understand what the problem is? And I remember I'm going to go back and finish up here with our dear departed sister, Lynn Stewart, who, when I met her in 1962, was her first teaching job in Harlem. It was her first teaching job, period. and it was my first teaching job in New York. I had taught 6 years in Pittsburgh in the same segregated type of schools, and I understood that the schools were just segregated. They weren't inferior. If you had a class and you could teach, the kids learned. And I am proud of the years and success I had educating. And I met Lynn Stewart, and she says, "What is this place?" And I says, "Well, this place represents every inner city in America." And she says, "We're in the middle of New York, and the schools are 99 and 9/10% black in Harlem." I said, "Harlem, Bed-Stuy, Bronx, etc. This is a segregated nation." And 6 months later, after she said, "You know, I've been a valedictorian of every class I was ever in," and when I met her college students, her friends, many, many years later after her arrest for so-called terrorism, which we know today is a joke, but it's no joke because they put her in the death camp when she had cancer. But she said to me, "Ralph, I didn't know about Harlem. I didn't know about inner cities across the country. So that tells me if I made an A in everything and I don't know, they lied to me. They didn't tell me what was going on." And she says, "Now I see." And she says, "What the problem with the public schools is not methodology, not what you're teaching, it's racism, pure and simple." And we have to understand our condition in America is due to a philosophy of racism. Somebody says, "Well, you can't have fascism unless you have a philosophy." And I say, "Well, how about racism? Pretty widespread. And I've been given a sign one more time that Sister Betty says you can't say it all in one night. And so we're going to have to give people a chance to say it. And so, once again, we're not going to be on for the month of July and August. The second week in September, we'll be back. And brothers and sisters and youth and elderly, I'm going to have a lot to say because a lot is happening. We are in dangerous times, and I'm going to go back to the human weakness that I started out with. We name our own struggle. The original sin is not slavery. The second sin is not of America, that is not keeping us ignorant politically and economically. It's the third or fourth, because the death of the indigenous people from sea to shining sea is the original sin in America. And remember when they brought the captured the bodies and the cultures from Africa, it was the basis of the Industrial Revolution, because as Marx says, you have to have surplus economy, and there was no surplus economy coming out of Europe. The surplus economy was coming out of America. There was no factory, no institution in Europe that produced the surplus value, the surplus money, as the plantations did. And here today, we're still fighting that same fight because we haven't learned our lesson. Louisiana, New Orleans, they're still doing the same things. We have our political prisoners, and now I see Sister Betty has a whip, and it's time for me to give other people to say something. And until September, see you again. And with our continuing tradition, we have Sister Nzinga following our dear Sister Lynn Stewart, our Professor Louie. Sister Nzinga, your microphone is open. Educate us. Get us started. Thank you one more time. The poet, Sister Nzinga.
Okay. 917. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, everybody. Good evening to everybody. I'm so excited on this last night to be on the station. Thank you again for inviting me, Sister Betty Davis. So, you know, it's been a lot of talk, Juneteenth. You know, people have been talking about freedom and justice and all that. So I decided to do a poem titled My Liberty, and it's just like a perception of what the so-called Emancipation Proclamation meant for myself and meant for our people. So here we go, My Liberty. The emancipation was never a proclamation of my liberation. It was a perpetuation of domination and indoctrination to keep me from pursuing real liberation. It was never written for my liberty. It actually prevented me from being free, did little to keep me from being oppressed, to hinder my progress. I always thought it unrealistic of me to think that my right to be free would come from those who constantly oppressed me, who made my liberty contingent upon a victory of a battle I wasn't even fighting for me. But in all reality, freedom to me is not determined by who they perceive me to be or the battles I fought for their victory. It is controlled by my mentality, not by how they define me. So I will always be free in spite of what they say about me. So I will excel beyond capacity, use my liberated mind to manifest my destiny. All of my dreams are reality, regardless of their false indoctrination or their attempts to distort how I view my emancipation. And that, to me, is the true meaning of my liberty.
Okie doke, as we say, poetry, educate and entertain. Teach, sister, keep on teaching, and keep that poetry out there. Keep people listening and learning. Thank you so much, and if this represents, and I'm afraid it doesn't, if this represents our youth, we're in good hands. But we must never give up the struggle and say we're turning it over to the youth. We better be youthful in thought and philosophy and planning. Thank you, Sister Nzinga. I look forward to seeing you in future programs, street in demonstrations, and in teaching situations. So teach, sister.
Before we go to our next warrior, I just want to give praise to Sister Nzinga. She's one of those warriors that's out there fighting for the latest African burial ground that we just discovered in Brooklyn on Church and Bedford Avenue, part of the Dutch Reformed Church Cemetery. But these Africans have no gravestones. Their enslavers have gravestones. And Sister Nzinga is one of a crew that's out there demanding that our ancestors be acknowledged and that we answer the call in the blood, among her many other activities. Without further ado, before we go to Brother Jihad Abdul-Mumit of Jericho, National Jericho, and also the Spirit of Mandela Human Rights Initiative, I want to acknowledge that we have another warrior in the house. As many of you know, we're getting ready to wage a battle to get back our public school system and to instill and insist on community control of public education. And many of us had our spirits lifted when we read recently that the community in Chicago overthrew mayoral control in that state. Today we are to have Brother Brandon Johnson, teachers union member. Also, Brother Johnson has been very active. He was a Democratic member of the Cook County Board of Commissioners representing the 1st District. He defeated the incumbent in the Democratic Party primary election for the district in March 2008 and won the general election unopposed in November. He has many other activities in his career, but he has always been an advocate for education, and especially community education. Brother Brandon Johnson, we are honored to have you. I had the pleasure of serving on a panel on education with Brother Brandon Johnson in Chicago some years ago for the Black is Back Coalition Conference. Your mic is open. We recognize that your time is short. Please enlighten us.
Thank you so much, sister. Thank you. It's an honor and privilege to be with you all this evening. I do apologize about the background noise. Of course, our work never ends here in Chicago or anywhere when you're fighting for Black liberation. So I'm really honored and looking forward to the discussion today. And it's been a real honor fighting alongside of you. As you indicated, the front row of our fight for justice has certainly played out in our public schools. And, you know, that continues to be a struggle and a war, quite frankly, all over the country. And we're just glad to be part of today's and tonight's discussion.
So would you please give us some insights on how the struggle was so successful against mayoral control in Chicago? Because we know you have to go soon.
Yeah, well, it's been a very long battle. Just for folks who need some context, the public schools in Chicago have been controlled and dominated by mayoral control for 150 years. The city of Chicago has never had an elected representative school board. And as a result of that, of course, we've seen a lot of the harm that has been done against Black children in particular. So school closings, school privatization through these for-profit charter schemes that really sucked the life out of the neighborhood schools. You saw a dismantling of the Black working class, where Black teachers have been targeted over the last 20 years. You've seen devastation. And so, you know, whether it's the west side of Chicago, south side of Chicago, wherever Black folks populated, the mayors of Chicago historically have used those budgets to ultimately fatten the pockets of their friends. And it's been a political space in order to, again, to enrich the powerful. And so over the last 10 years in particular, though this has been a fight for the last 25 plus years, over the last 10 years, there's been an incredible movement where labor and community organizations have come together to take on those powerful forces. And so whether that was Rahm Emanuel, Mayor Daley, over the course of, again, 50 years in particular, where one family had pretty much dominated the fifth floor, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, before he went out, continued that legacy of attacking Black workers, attacking Black children, and using the schools as a way to ultimately fatten the pockets of the wealthy. And so we've organized collectively, again, community-based organizations that are led by Black parents. We had a real infusion of educators, as you all may be aware. Back in 2012, the Chicago Teachers Union went on a strike, first time in 25 years where a strike took place in Chicago. And then after that, 2016, 2019. And so through these organizing efforts of parents, teachers, the faith community, labor leaders, all of these different groups, you know, finally came together to begin to push back really hard 10 years ago, marching in the streets, hunger strikes, families literally starving themselves to have a neighborhood school in their neighborhood that kids can actually walk to. So this has been a long battle. And so finally we had to take, you know, obviously legislative action. The mayor has control over Chicago public schools through the legislature, and the legislature granted that control in the tight grip that it had back in 1995, I believe. And so through, again, these parent-led, rank-and-file member-led of unions against mayoral control, we begin to not only organize in various communities that have been devastated by these awful, wicked privatization schemes that have really just crushed the life out of these communities. We begin to lead these campaigns of ballot referendums. And everywhere we went, sister, communities across the city of Chicago overwhelmingly supported an elected representative school board. But the General Assembly in Springfield, our state capital, those legislators weren't listening. And so a sister out of our movement ran for office back in 2014 and 2016. Though she lost both times for a state rep race, it really changed the dynamics of how we govern public schools. And through the campaigns, the ballot referendums, and actually going after Democrats who were not supporting democracy. I'm going to just repeat that. Democrats who were not supporting democracy, given agency to the voices of black parents in particular, who have been harmed by these awful school policies, we begin to take the fight directly to the ballot box. And in many cases, we won local seats on the city council. As you indicated, I ran for county government. 5 million people in Cook County that encompasses Chicago. We beat an entrenched incumbent there that was tied to the privatization movement. We ran state people for the state house. And as a result of those campaigns, we really begin to push and challenge Springfield, where the laws are passed for the state of Illinois to fully accept the elected representative school board. I know that's a quick version of a 10-year history, but it's been a long battle, but a battle that has been worth it. And so now we'll have a fully elected representative school board, even though it did not turn out exactly the way we wanted it. We wanted a fully elected representative school board in 23. What we have is we'll have half of the board will be elected in 24, and we'll finally have a fully elected representative school board in 26.
Well, thank you so much for that. And do not forget the budget, the budget, the budget. The budget has to represent the community in terms of jobs, contracts, the budget. And I'm thinking back to that wonderful struggle in Chicago, Karen Lewis, Chuy Garcia, et cetera, 2014, 2015, 2017, a wonderful struggle. We're going to try to keep up to you folks and try to do better in all of our inner cities, because education, contracts, and a budget says the whole thing. So thank you so much for educating us. Come back again.
Thank you for lifting up the voice of Karen Lewis. Obviously, people know that she made a transition, but this movement was brought to us by her struggle and her incredible sacrifice. And you're absolutely right. Chicago Public Schools, brother, we're talking about a $7 billion budget, and that's what they don't want to give or hand over to community. But, again, a long fight, a long battle. But the battle doesn't end, because now we got to go and get good people elected. So I'm definitely looking forward to coming back on another evening, and I do appreciate the work that you all are doing and lifting up our fights all over the country.
Well, Brother Brandon, you know we are still with the Black is Back Coalition, and August, the first weekend in August, we're going to be doing it again on a Zoom. And I really want to invite you, if you are available any one of those days, to join our education panel. The discussion of strategy is very important. The use of people running for office, the use of people going into the community and telling and organizing and making sure that the parents are leading this struggle is the lesson to be learned. And I really appreciate you talking about these black politicians who were pro-charter schools and were pro-mayoral control, because we got such a traitor in New York City. His name is Eric Adams, and the last I heard, he's leading in the mayoral campaign in New York. He is pro-mayoral control, as are many of the candidates who are running for that position. So that is why...
Well, you're spot on. I'm glad you lifted that up, and I'm definitely, let's figure out that first weekend in August. But the current mayor that we have now, the city of Chicago finally was able to elect another black mayor, and this black mayor ran on an elected representative school board. Once she got in office, she changed her mind. She went back on her promise. And so this is why we have to continue to make sure that we lead our movements, because people will try to insert themselves in our struggle and get elected off of our struggle, but they don't want to lead through the struggle. And so we got work to do in Chicago as well, because in many cases, these folks make promises in order to gain support and to get elected. And that's what this mayor did. Shame on her, but we'll deal with that in a couple of years. So I'm happy to try to figure out in August. And thank you so much for the work that you all are doing. Really, it means a lot to the struggle for black liberation, and particularly for black families who've been a part of this battle and this fight forever.
Well, thanks again. And remember the two T words when we're talking about representation: traitors and terrorized folk. These representatives are terrorized because they were selected by the Democratic Party for us to elect. Always remember that. They selected them. They have the money. We have to have the heart, the energy. And we got it, as for people like yourself. So the struggle continues. Sister Betty.
And in conclusion, I want to let you know no good deed ever goes unpunished. I am active in a group of concerned parents and educators who've been around a long time fighting for community control of education. And I certainly want to invite you. I will her name is Sister Brenda Walker, is one of our organizers, and Sister Muva is a second organizer for this parent group. They work very closely with Charles Barron, whom I'm sure you have heard about, to try to bring about the struggle for community control and justice in the education system. Your struggle is so important, and that's all I can say. I can't say it enough. We've got to get the word out that we can win, and that's what this program is all about. We don't just say, woe is me. We say we can win, and I admire Chicago, and you guys just keep it going. So put August, first weekend in August in your calendar.
Second week in September.
And the second week in September, our broadcast will resume. We hope you will resume also. Thank you again. I know you have to go. I see that
Thank
we
you
have
so much.
We'll
see you all.
Yes.
Good night, my brother.
We have another guest who needs to follow up, and we've had this guest before. He has to get off the mic. He has another commitment. Dr. Harris from Seton Hall, your mic is open. Thank you for joining us yet again.
Good evening. Power to the people. Thank you all for having me again on this auspicious occasion. I want to thank the brother for talking about Sister Karen Lewis, and we got to continue to lift her up and the struggle that people have been fighting for in Chicago. I was in Chicago for 10 years, so I know very well the struggle over the school system there that's happening. So we definitely need to continue to push them up. And I definitely, it's interesting, you know, we are on the eve of another July 4th celebration. And I want to read something and just put a couple things in context and for us to remember for this celebration. And I'm going to read, and I'll let you all know who I'm reading from in a minute. But although this anniversary affords occasion of rejoicing to the mass of the people of the United States, there is a class, a numerous class, consisting of nearly 3 million who participate but little in its joys and are deprived of their unalienable rights by the very men who so loudly rejoiced in the declaration that all men are born free and equal. The festivities of this day serve to impress upon the minds of reflecting men of color a deeper sense of the cruelty, the injustice, and oppression of which they have been the victims. While others rejoice in their deliverance from a foreign yoke, they mourn that a yoke of a thousandfold more grievous is fastened upon them. Alas, they are slaves in the midst of freedom. They are slaves to those who boast that freedom is the unalienable right of all. And the clanking of their fetters and the voice of their wrongs make a hard discord in the songs of freedom which resound through the land. Now, that many people would think I was reading from Frederick Douglass in July 5th, 1852 speech. But this is actually from Peter Williams, July 4th, 1830. And I say that, yes. And I say that because I want people to understand that Frederick Douglass was standing on the shoulders of people who had before him for decades been talking about the July 4th celebration is not ours. People had
right
been
on.
Reminding America of that. So Peter Williams, who was an early leader in the Negro Convention movement, early leader in the black church, early leader in New York, a black New Yorker, right? Peter Williams, the Reverend Peter Williams, gave that speech on July 4th, 1830. Reminding the country of that Independence Day was theirs and not ours. And I want people to be mindful. So when Frederick Douglass comes 22 years later and talks about what to the slave is the 4th of July, he gave that speech on July 5th because by that time black New Yorkers had said we're not even going to celebrate on July 4th. We're going to celebrate on July 5th. So when Frederick Douglass was asked to come speak on July 4th, he said, no, I'll do it on July 5th. And he said, do you intend to mock me by bringing me here to speak and celebrate in this celebration that you have? And he said, no, this celebration is yours, is not ours. And we have to remember that. And we have, even in the context of what we're talking about schools, we have to remember that 2 years before Frederick Douglass did that, there's a black lawyer named Robert Morris in Boston, along with Charles Sumner, who took a case of a black man named Benjamin Roberts, who sued the city of Boston for not allowing his daughter to attend a segregated school. So that was one of the first law school suits in this country, right? So that lawsuit was 1850, Charles Sumner and Robert Morris, one of the first black lawyers in the country. I think he was the second, actually. And by 1855, they won. The city of Boston became the first state to outlaw segregated education in 1855. Now, we know about the backlash later that goes against that and stops people from doing that. What they want to be mindful, when we think about July 4th and celebrating, we're not celebrating that. We're celebrating the Robert Morrises, the Charles Sumners, the Frederick Douglass, the Peter Williams, the Richard Allens, the Mariah Stewarts, the people that fought for this country to make this country true to what it says on paper. We're celebrating the people that fought for public education for all, free and equal public education for all. That was black people on the front line. We're fighting for people who fought for the right to vote for black men and for black women. That's who we're fighting for. We're fighting for people who've been fighting for human rights for people, the end to not only physical slavery, but also that slavery that we know as the new Jim Crow. We're fighting for those people and for the political prisons. We're fighting for them. We're celebrating for them, the people that have been on the front line all these years trying to bring America really into a civilization, to being what it says on paper. And we need to remember that. This is a great tradition that always goes back. Black folk have always been doing it since we got here, since the 19th, saying this is a great contradiction in this society. You claim freedom, justice, liberty, and equality, but what about us? And not only that, when we're fighting for us, we're fighting for everybody. We're saying that this is what this country needs to look like, not only domestically, but internationally. How do we treat people? How do we respect human rights and civil rights? So I want us to remember that on this July 4th weekend coming up.
Well, preach, Professor Harris, preach. This is what we're talking about. Educate, educate, educate. And as I say, when I listen to this program, I listen to it over and over again during the week because it is archived and it raises the hairs on my skin. Wonderful. Sister Betty.
Before we let Professor Harris go, I want to remind him that Queen Mother Moore said there was no point in celebrating July 4th. And she always had a political event up on her farm in Ellensburg, New York, because she wanted to expose the lie of what July 4th was all about. And you just reminded me of all the different programs and all the years that she had the alternative to July 4th. I thank you.
That's right.
And I thank you for being on.
The 4th of July. Thank you.
I remember it was the first time I heard Chokwe Lumumba speak. It was back on one of those anti-4th of July events that Queen Mother Moore held up in the Catskills. And, yes, the struggle is long, and we have to pursue it in every way possible. Thank you again.
And I want to, again, raise up Sister Nzinga. She's the continuation of that tradition when she says, what are they talking about, this freedom? This is not my freedom. I still got mine to get. And Queen Mother Moore would have loved her poem so much. It is a continuation of the tradition of struggle, of answering the call of the blood. And when we fight for our ancestors to have gravestones, that's what we are doing. Thank you, Dr. Harris. I really, really cannot say enough. Okay, we got to go forward. We got another teacher in the house. Brother Tom, your mic is open. And once again, people, we want to remind you that we will be back in September, the second week of September. Don't you leave us. Don't give up on us. And we will be replaying different broadcasts. And I recommend that you get on Blog Talk Radio, Human Rights Demands, and look up the different Ralph Point of What's Happening programs and let me know what dates you want us to program for the next two months. Brother Tom, your mic is open.
Thank you very much. I want to talk about the need for community control of the school system, particularly with what's happening to the public sector retirees who are facing an end to their health care benefits as they stand now, that is Medicare, and the city picks up the cost of the supplementary insurance. The city and the sellout union leaders are negotiating to end this system and put us under a privatized health care system. I want to read excerpts from people who have contributed in exposing this whole thing. After killing a single-payer bill, the city public sector labor unions are trying to force 250,000 public sector workers from Medicare into pricier for-profit insurance plans. Advantage comes from both higher co-payments, essentially shifting costs from the government to individuals, as well as the fact that people receive less care either due to high claim denials or because they don't seek out the care in the first place. In the beginning, with the formation of municipal unions, the city gave unions control over their health plans with a bureaucracy and a patronage system. Thus, the UFT, Health and Welfare Fund, which is not paid by the union but by the city, gave the union leaders a windfall to play around with. The calls for moving the entire process under public management threatens both the insurance companies and the union leaderships. So the unions made sure to kill the New York State single-payer bill, and despite claiming to support a national Medicare for all, our union lines up with the Democrat Party in supporting the privatized health care system. U of T President Mulgrew complains about health care costs and how we have to reduce them. Savings, he calls, but the savings come from us, certainly not reducing or eliminating profits. If Mulgrew wants savings, he should check the cost in Europe, which are half ours, and those countries have various forms of universal health care. In essence, by opposing public options, Mulgrew and other union leaders are fighting to keep health care prices higher. In January 2021, a study by the New School found that the city could save about $1.6 billion per year if it adopted a self-insurance program, as most major cities and large companies have done. That would involve setting up a health insurance plan just for the city employees and paying for claims directly rather than paying premiums to health insurance companies, which tend to be much more expensive. But the negotiations between the Municipal Labor Council and the Office of Labor Relations were held behind closed doors. Retirees don't know whether this option was even considered. And UFT retirees will notice that our chapter leaders have never told us about that option. Retirees pointed out that the Municipal Labor Council personnel with ties to the health insurance company that could end up providing the new Medicare Advantage plans as potential conflicts of interest. Gregory Floyd, president of the Teamsters Local 237 and secretary of the Municipal Labor Council, is on the board of Emblem Health. The secretary of the Municipal Labor Council is on the board of Emblem Health. I've always been suspicious of the union's devotion to private insurance. Do we think the insurance companies don't lobby our union leaders? the explanation of it for why our unions want to stick with privatized plans. For a lot of these unions, one tangible thing they provide, in addition to wages, are health care benefits, and particularly the benefits that come out of the welfare funds, said one Union City union representative speaking on condition of anonymity. They want health care benefits associated with union leadership. The reasons go deeper. In the beginning, the city gave union control over health plans with a bureaucracy and a patronage system. Thus, the UFT Health and Welfare Fund, which is not paid by the union but by the city, gave union leaders a windfall. After killing a single-payer bill, the city public sector labor unions are trying to force a quarter million retirees from Medicare into pricier for-profit insurance plans. And in recent years, leadership of some of the nation's largest unions have publicly opposed single-payer health care proposals, angering their rank and file, and forcing Democrat politicians who back a single-payer to take on another, to drop their support of single-payer. In New York City, the umbrella organization for the city public unions is the Municipal Labor Council, and recently helped the health insurance industry block a statewide single-payer bill on the grounds that their members wanted to keep health care benefits for which they had sacrificed wage increases. But it turns out that the Municipal Labor Council, which bargained for health care benefits for city unions, was also engaging in backdoor negotiations with the city, resulting in a proposal to switch nearly a quarter million from Medicare to privately administered so-called Medicare Advantage plans.
Thank you, Tom. We're going to have to respond.
So I'm going to end up by saying that public sector workers who are not retired and the retirees are organizing a demonstration down. It's going to start at the Museum of Native Americans down near the Battery, and they're going to march over the Brooklyn Bridge tomorrow at noon, and I hope that whoever is available will participate in this. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that, Tom Syracuse, a past teacher, an educator, and he's educating the people. And when that happened, when the unions supported a corporate Medicare as opposed to a national health care system, jaws dropped. My jaw dropped. How can these people be in position? The same way the Democratic Party stays in position, by lying or not talking about certain issues. They got away with this one again. We need Julian Assange. People are going to tell us what's happening. We need Tom Syracuse. People who are going to...
One more short point. I'm wondering if this demonstration is going to be covered by the mass media tomorrow. I would be surprised if it gets even any coverage.
Yes, and like I said, we're covering it. Tom Syracuse is covering it. Listen in to be educated. Thanks again. Enjoy your vacation, Tom. You have earned it. And see you in September, Sister Betty.
And I want to remind you, Tom, that the Zool is organizing a political prisoners unity protest the park
September
19th. And we are hoping you will come and be one of the guest speakers. One of the things that I hope everybody on this call understands is we've all got to unite with our different issues, because it's the same corporate evil oppressors that's robbing and strangling all of us. You heard the brother from Chicago. You heard Brother Tom. It's the same corporate oppressive elite system, and that's what the Panthers were fighting against. And it is an honor to introduce our next speaker. He is the head of National Jericho, a brother who did several decades for trying to liberate funds for the Black Liberation Movement. I mean none other than
Jihad Abdul Mumit from the National Jericho. Jihad, please tell your story.
And be sure to include the latest human rights initiative that you are spearheading and getting people all over the world to recognize that we still have combatants that are incarcerated. Brother Jihad is open.
Oh, wow. What an introduction. Thank you, Brother Ralph and Sister Betty. Assalamu alaikum, listening audience. It's an honor to always present on the program. And it seemed like it was just last year I was talking on the last program also, and time flies, I guess, as they say. You know, but, yeah, so, again, it's an honor, and I was really taking in fully all the presenters before me and the information, the powerful information that they presented. And so just a little bit of myself, I am the chairperson of the National Jericho Movement, and we are a vanguard organization that was started in 1998 by Safia Bukhari and Herman Ferguson and recently released political prisoner Jalil Muta King. And so that's from 1998 to now, which is quite admirable for revolutionary organizations as such in terms of sustainability. And what we do is we represent political prisoners. And when we say represent political prisoners, we're talking primarily about those who have come out of the Black Liberation Movements and the American Indian Movement, Puerto Rican nationalists when they were in prison, anti-imperialists, and animal rights activists, and some recent political prisoners in current times, you know, but mostly those that are in prison because of their political positions and what they fought for, our freedom fighters, regardless of actions committed or they were set up and framed by the counterintelligence FBI programs, they are political prisoners. The United States says there aren't any. We know that there are plenty. So when we say represent political prisoners, as Ralph and Betty know, we're talking about tending to their medical needs as they're getting older, having third-party doctor representation to check on them, having sponsoring and paying for lawyers to represent them, all the way from compassionate release or going up before the parole board and providing that logistical support for them to make sure they're alive and well and not being mistreated the best that we can in the circumstances that they are in. We're talking about paying for family visits. We visit them ourselves, food packages. In New York City, we have Joy Powell and David Gilbert. And Joy, I understand now, listening to Ann right before the call, Ralph and Betty, that, you know, she's doing fine, considering, of course. And I think she's going for a colonoscopy pretty soon. David Gilbert, I had the honor of talking to him just the other day on the phone when I was on a Zoom call. He called in. And he's still, you know, the whole thing with compassionate release, and not only in the state of New York, but all across 49 states, is really has been a, pretty much a joke when it comes to political prisoners and prisoners that are doing serious time that should not even be there in the first place. And for the listening audience, I will say that in a real sense that all incarcerations are political. So we're just making the distinction only by virtue of the fact that those that have actually fought for freedoms and took a political position. But we all of our cases going through a racist judicial system, federal and state, we're victimized by a political system that is very racist indeed. I want to, listening to the Betty and Ralph, listening to the previous speakers, I just wanted to announce to you, and I really want the listeners to take note of this, that we have an initiative that's been called for by political prisoners and from forming a coalition a couple of years ago called the Spirit of Mandela. And out of this coalition, we're planning on October this year, 2021, International Tribunal. And I just wanted to say, Ralph and Betty, just for just a second, just to explain some unique features about this particular tribunal and why it is so important and how it embraces all the issues that the previous speakers have presented from Chicago to New York, and how and why this tribunal is very important. And hopefully you listening to this, you'll be able to tune in with it and become involved with it, because this is indeed a people's tribunal, and your critical thinking, your imagination, your ideas, and your strength and wisdom is very important to make this process work. This is not a situation where you have a room full of attorneys, if you will, all due respect, coming up with a human rights indictment and having it live stream and present it for everybody to see, and then presenting the findings to somewhere in the United Nations Human Rights Council or whatever, and then afterwards absolutely nothing happening. This is not that at all. This is, as Jalil says, we are our own liberators. This is a movement where the tribunal is just an event in time, and we're charging, you know, police violence against black, brown, indigenous people, mass incarceration, black, brown, indigenous people, the freedom of political prisons, environmental racism and health disparities, and, of course, we're charging genocide. And this is human rights violations on the international stage and civil rights violations on the domestic level also. And so after this, the most important thing that we're talking about doing is having serious outcomes. One of the most pronounced outcomes will be the establishment of a people's Senate. You have the U.S. Senate, you have the House of Representatives, Congress, and now we want to establish our own Senate where we have representation across all 50 contiguous states by people that come from our own with a revolutionary integrity to address these issues from all the way from education, as Sister Betty is always talking about, to the freedom of our political prisoners, to health care, to just our whole livelihood and the development of our communities. Sisters and brothers, I cannot tell you how important this initiative is. You want to talk about something to do, a strategy that's very embracing, that's going to bring us together. This is not event orientated. This is a strategy to move us to a total another level of organizing amongst people. This is bringing us out of our organizations and out dealing with our own peers and small groupings into a much more larger organizing level and mobilizing level where we can influence folks. You know, involved in this whole process, Black is Back Coalition, the Black Alliance for Peace, the National Jericho Movement, and many other organizations have signed on. Now we have hundreds of people signed on. Through the work and effort of Betty and Ralph, involved with the Black is Back Coalition, if I might say, to toot your horn a little bit, sister and brother, is that they've been able to recruit, you know, almost a couple of hundred of people that's involved in working with political prisoners. Those people have been involved in, have been integrated into this whole Mandela process with the tribunal, and we're asking you, listeners, to become involved also. How you can do this? By logging into our website, spiritofmandela.org, spiritofmandela.org. That is the easiest way to find out all the information, what I'm talking about. You can read about the charges. The legal team is being led by Nkechi Taisi, who is a black woman that has a rich history in the liberation struggle, and many, many good people involved. And we are asking you directly, sisters and brothers listening, to become involved in this process too. It's not asking you to leave your organizations, to abandon your own mission statements or anything like that, but it's to take your acumen, your integrity, your skills, your wisdom, and your beautiful self, come involved in this people's process so that we can really make an impact, you know, moving forward in a place called the United States of America.
Well, thank you. There's two things I'd like to add to that. The spirit of Mandela includes Nelson and Winnie Mandela and Jihad. If you could just give us a quick picture of your involvement in international struggle.
Yes, I was a member of the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army. I did 23 years in prison. It was a political case, obviously, for bank expropriations. We were getting money to book for the land question. For those old enough to know and those that have studied enough to know that the Republic of New Africa called for the establishment of a black socialist state, and from that would be Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, South Carolina. You know, you can't do that by having bake sales, I might tell you. And back then, we recognized who the enemy was. And this is definitely war. And that's what we were fighting. and we were ready to fight it on all different levels. We talked about protecting ourselves, and we're talking about really going for it and establishing our own state, raising our own government, raising our own flag, if you will. So my involvement is there. I joined the Panther Party when I was 16. I'm 66 years old now. We're still involved. We're still kicking it. I've traveled all over to the United Nations in Geneva many times, United Nations right there where you guys are at in Manhattan to talk about the issue of political prisoners and many other issues, including the independence of Puerto Rico and issues of this nature. I've traveled around the world talking about just that. And I've seen, sisters and brothers, the fact that we have been really duped. And Ralph and Betty talking about being duped, about the fact that acknowledging political prisons and how we have to struggle to make our own sisters and brothers in the communities recognize that we have freedom fighters and how they cannot be abandoned or left behind or ignored. The United States government has been very successful with this narrative. I've traveled around the world talking about it, and everywhere I go, for the most part, people are looking at you like a deer caught in the headlights of a car. Oh, we have freedom fighters, so you champion. You mean to tell me that you champion freedom fighters throughout history all over the world, and when it comes to the United States, we don't have any? We don't have any? And so my main question is, however you feel about that, it's the same question I always ask everybody. When you open a history book and you see a picture of Nat Turner, do you see a freedom fighter or do you see a criminal? And we have many freedom fighters that are in prison today. And we need to recognize them, acknowledge them, and support them. If you say right now to yourself, I wonder who they are, it's easy to find out, sisters and brothers. You got an $800 cell phone. Everybody has one. You just ask your cell phone, you know, who are the political prisoners in the United States. And I guarantee you the same people that we're talking about now will pop up on your cell phone. So while you're looking at TikTok and all of these other things and just scrolling through Facebook and Instagram and everything, we can use our device to really educate ourselves and organize ourselves as opposed to using our device to just preoccupy our time with a bunch of nonsense and filling in so many minutes and weeks and months of our time. We end up doing absolutely nothing for our own liberation. And I'm being kind of hard like that. When I was growing up, you know, and anybody that's on this call that's 50 years and older, know that we didn't have cell phones when we were growing up. So, oh, guess what? You had to read a book. Now, you know, we don't do these type of things. I'm telling you, I'm charging everybody on this call. Everybody on this call, with due full respect, in full respect, I'm charging everybody that you need to research. If you don't know who our freedom fighters are from the liberation movements of the 60s and 70s, you ask your cell phone, you get on your laptop, you Google the Jericho Movement, there's a whole list of prisoners up there, and you can send them commissary, you can write them. They can be, this is the most direct way of connecting with anything in the past. It's supporting a live of individuals that's alive right now that's a freedom fighter. This is more potent than even reading a book before they die in prison. So we're talking about all the way from Mumia Abu-Jamal to Jamil Alameen, formerly known as H.R.A.P. Brown, to Dr. Matullah Shakur, to Afia Siddiqui, to Veronica Bowers, to many that you don't know. We're asking you to find out who they are, and it is our responsibility. Anybody that champions the cause, a humanitarian cause, a human rights cause, a civil rights cause, whatever you, and you do not acknowledge the freedom fighters that represent before us, then guess what? You know what the government knows? You know what the government knows? They know that you and I will not represent those that go to jail tomorrow. Any Black Lives Matter activist that went to prison and jail because they were accused of breaking a window, of burning a building, or just standing there getting tear gas in the face, the government knows that you and I will not support them because we're not used to doing that. Well, we better get used to doing that. And that's my charge out of
Hi, Leslie. Thank
everybody.
You so much.
There you go. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. And
yeah, I got Leonard and Shannon.
And that's Brother Reyes from Pacifica, KPFK, going to give us talk about what's important in information and the problem with Pacifica, what we're facing. They don't want us to know in the past, and they're trying to keep us learning and getting information in the And this is why they're fighting against community radio, their efforts to shut it down. Brother Lawrence Reyes.
And before that, thank you, Brother Jihad. We appreciate you, and we appreciate the struggle. A Spirit of Mandela, go to the website, spiritofmandela.org. Thank you, Brother Jihad.
Thank you very much.
They were also sending money to support the struggles in Africa, the liberation struggles in Africa, in that southern hot tip where it's first shown a light that seems to be dimming now. But this is how far back it goes, the sacrifice of his years and his family, and he's still here with us. What can we say to that? Brother Lawrence Reyes.
I want to give a shout-out to Brother Lawrence, who is always lifting up our political prisoners, who submitted the motion of support for Mamia Abu-Jamal, and who keeps the thoughts and minds of our political prisoners before the public. Brother Lawrence, thank you for returning again. They don't want us to have schools. They don't want us to have community radio.
No, they don't. And so I just want to I dedicate my appearance on your show to another warrior that has transitioned to the ancestor, who was constantly a target of Contopro and the FBI, and that's Leonard Crow Dog, the spiritual chief of the American Indian Movement. So when we talk about warriors and we talk about being fortified by ancestors, those are our ancestors. I stand on stolen land built by stolen people. And so I am here to encourage you to vote no on the referendum, the corporate attempt to hijack Pacifica Radio away from the community and from the people and away from the liberation struggle. I encourage you to visit www.pacifica.org. And I encourage you also to visit RadioJustice.org, where I am producing my show right now. And so I'm also going to include this little clip on my show, if that's okay with you, Brother Ralph and Sister Betty.
That is more than okay with us. I knew that you would give us a pick-me-up and an informative talk on what we must do. And what Brother Reyes is talking about is the corporate attempt take over community, the Pacifica Radio, and there is a ballot going out, a referendum on.
Okay,
do we
I'm,
want?
I'm gonna start in 1 minute.
Okay, let him start.
Okay,
all right.
I'm good, Brother Ralph. I got to go. Ache to our ancestors and to all your guests. And again, thank you for much. Thank you so much. And let's remember all the political prisoners, Leonard Crow Dog, who was a political prisoner, Leonard Pelte, who's still in the dungeons, Mumia, Sudi Akuli, and all our warriors, as Jihad said before I got on. Thank you so much, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. I have to sign off.
Sister Betty.
Thank you, Brother Reyes, thank you so much. Without further ado, we're going to go to Sister Dolores, and we see Brother Joel is in the house and Brother Dennis. So we're asking you, along with Brother Henry Higgins, please hang in there. Thank you. We've extended our time, and we will continue to extend it to get everybody in. Thank you. Okay, Sister Dolores, your mic is open. We don't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm here. I wanted to comment on mayoral control of schools and community control of schools. So Wikipedia has a description of mayoral control of schools as governance over American schools based on the business model in which the mayor of a city replaces the elected board of education / school board with an appointed board. The mayor may also directly appoint the head of the school system, superintendent, or chancellor. Mayoral control of schools is in contrast to the structure it represents and replaces, which was an elected board that governed schools independently from the formal influence of the mayor. Mayors govern the school districts in two of the United States' three largest cities, that is Chicago since 1995 in New York City since 2002. Perhaps the most profile case of mayoral control is New York City, where Mayor Bloomberg won the right to appoint the heads of schools in June 2002. New York's mayors also have the power to select the head of schools in addition to appointing 8 of 13 school board members. That's the description of mayoral control of the schools, according to Wikipedia. And in terms of the school system governance, the New York City public school system has fundamentally changed its governance 4 times since the past 40 years. It moved from 1970 from a highly centralized bureau to a more community-based decentralized system, both of which were independent of the mayor. However, in 2002, under mayoral control, the system again centralized, and then in 2007, decentralized. In each instance, New York has been an example, for good or bad, that many of other large cities are following. The political and organizational dynamics of Mayor Bloomberg and Chancellor Klein's new mode of governance is the first phase of mayoral control. And then it goes on to say, mayoral control is the largest public school system in the United States. Mayoral control of the largest public system in the United States is New York City. The stimulus for the change to mayoral control comes from big city mayors, business leaders, state and city appointed and elected officials, and the competitiveness in the social and economic problems of inner cities. Okay. So there's also been a discussion lately within the past year or so about mayoral control of schools as opposed to the former fractured system of locally elected school boards. And the mayoral control of city schools is written into state law, and any changes would need the approval of state lawmakers. After a rather long process of investigation of what we can do in 2022, state lawmakers have extended de Blasio's tenure over city schools until 2022 after he leaves office. In varying degrees, parent leaders describe wanting more power on community education councils, which are the parent-led boards in each school district that are tasked with approving school rezoning plans. One example, and giving these bodies say over the hiring of the school chancellor is what they want input in. And it says both the mayor and the chancellor have also faced criticism for not embracing integration policies forcefully enough in what is considered the nation's most segregated school system, New York City. When lawmakers extended mayoral control, they also approved some tweaks to membership of parent councils and the panel for education policy, a mayor-appointed board that must approve major education department contracts and policy changes, but it's largely viewed as a rubber stamp for whoever's in office. So that's what I wanted to add about mayoral control. A few years ago in The Nation magazine, there was an article stating that for as long as there have been teachers' unions, and they date back to 1897, there have been tensions between them and other progressives committed to public education. But it wasn't until the urban teachers' strike of the late 1960s and early 1970s, when unions opposed black and Hispanic community control in favor of job security for predominantly white teachers, that the unions became downright villains, not only to anti-labor conservatives, but for the first time to large segments of the American left. In the push for community control, we see a precedent for many of today's school reform battles. As northern school boards and mayors resisted desegregation in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education with the hopes for an integrated great society, the community control and black power movements loomed with a forceful critique of teachers' unions, a critique that was eagerly adopted by the liberal elite and one that remains potent today. over 95% of public school students in Ocean Hill, Brownsville were black and Latino, while two-thirds of the teachers were white. In response to parents' complaints, and in order to forestall demands to bus children out of poor neighborhoods to better schools, Mayor John Lindsay, in the spring of 1967, had granted community control to, and that's in quotes, to Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and two other New York City neighborhoods. The movement had been inspired by young Black Panther leaders like Stokely Carmichael, who argued in 1966 that, quote, we cannot have white people working in the black community. On psychological grounds, black people must be in the position of power, doing and articulating for themselves. And subsequently, with funding from the Ford Foundation, Ocean Hill Brownsville held elections for a community board, which then hired Rhody McCoy, a principal with ties to the Black Power movement, to lead the newly formed independent district. Several years after an uncontrollable incident in an art class, McCoy and the community board dismissed that teacher and teachers of and 18 other white teachers and administrators. The dismissals were not terminations per se. They simply asked the selected teachers to report to city school board headquarters for new assignments. But McCoy clearly intended to send a message that black parents and administrators deserve veto power of the employment of white teachers. But there remains the question of what could be done about teachers who were just plain bad at their jobs. U of T established an informal backstage process for removing, or more accurately, juggling ineffective tenured teachers, and that a teacher would be transferred, their solution, a teacher would be transferred to another school. Bad teachers hopped from school to school as a result. The union, the UFT, sent several of the dismissed Ocean Hill Brownsville teachers back to work, where they were met by activists, some affiliated with black separatist groups, who physically prevented them from entering school buildings. 2 weeks later, when 350 UFT teachers walked out of the Ocean Hill Brownsville schools in solidarity with their dismissed colleagues, the mayor hadn't yet approved McCoy's plans and didn't know how to react. This seemingly local event triggered not only the most infamous and largest teacher strike in American history, but also a political and racial crisis of national proportions, which continues to reverberate in almost every debate about contemporary school reforms. Community control advocates argued that the education of poor black and brown children was too urgent a matter to bother with labor protections and bureaucratic protocol. Much the same argument we hear from opponents of teacher tenure today. On the other side, the UFT unionists feared and argued loudly that a community control movement affiliated with black power separatism could potentially turn neighborhood schools into places of political indoctrination. In reality, the Ocean Hill Brownsville dismissals were as much about competence as ideology. They are teacher who had been transferred from one middle school previously by a principal had also complained that he lacked classroom management skills, that same art teacher that McCoy was addressing. Ocean Hill Brownsville, a neighborhood where parents had been organizing in favor of a more traditional approach, which was structured lessons, stricter discipline, and longer school day. During the summer of 68, a judge ordered McCoy to reinstate 10 of the dismissed teachers, along with the 350 who had struck in solidarity the previous May. And this was at Junior High School 271. The union president, Al Schenker, huh?
And on that note, you're going to have to conclude.
Oh, okay. Okay, but I just want to add, I went to elementary school and junior high school in Ocean Hill, and never once did I ever see a black teacher in either one of those buildings.
Well, we have to recognize that the Ocean Hill-Brownsville struggle was hijacked by the Democratic Party and some people of color who pretended to be
supporting the community. We're really working for the Ford Foundation. And the movement was hijacked. I went to jail coming out of that situation. I was a teacher, and I fought for community control. And I didn't realize what I was talking about. What I was talking about was $20 billion a year on a school budget. That's big time. Now it's $30 billion, was reduced to $27 billion by Cuomo, and the government added $7 billion on for COVID. So now it's $34 billion, but we've been hijacked and we have been denied entrance into control of anything. Control of the money, control of the educational policies, and we have been denied life because if you're not educated, they kill you. You do not have a sense of reality and a sense of life. Thank you for that, Sister Dolores Cox. Sister Betty, who was also a principal several times, successful teacher, successful librarian, successful organizer. Will you have a point of view on this?
I'm going to have to forego my point of view because I want to make sure that after Brother Henry Higgins speaks, we have Brother Joel, who's waiting in the wings. And we've extended the time, as I said, but we want to make sure we get him in. This discussion on education tonight has been encyclopedic. It is worthy of an encyclopedia. And I'm indebted to Brother Brandon Johnson, Sister Dolores Cox, and Tom Syracuse for enlightening us. I really do appreciate it. So before we go to Joel, Brother Henry, thank you for hanging in there with us. I appreciate you. Please, your mic is open.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. It's an honor and a pleasure. I want to share with the group tonight a number of words of wisdom that I think resonate and are applicable to this day. The first two are uttered by Rosa Luxemburg. Number one, those who do not move do not notice the chains. Number two, there is no democracy without socialism, and no socialism without democracy. Number three, writing is a struggle against silence. Carlos Fuentes. Number four, ability is sexless. John Henry Newman. Number five, service to others is the rent you pay for your room here on earth. Muhammad Ali. Number six, our power is that of the working people. Fidel. Number seven, the bravest are surely those who have the clearest vision of what is before them, glory and danger alike, and yet, notwithstanding, go out to meet it. Number eight, the less you think about your oppression, the more your tolerance grows. After a while, people just think oppression is a normal state of things. But to become free, you have to be acutely aware of being a slave, Assata Shakur. And I'll leave it at that.
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Henry Higgins with words of wisdom, brief but to the point. You must listen to this. It's archived. Dial it in to the whole program. And if you just get these few short minutes, you will be educated, as I am being educated again this evening. Sister Betty.
All right. We've got Brother Joel and Brother Dennis, a powerful way to go home. Okay, Brother Joel, your mic is open. Brother Dennis, we see you and understand you and Sister Belinda and Dr. Crenshaw are striking them out in Louisiana. Brother Joel, go ahead, please. And thank you for waiting.
Joel, your mic is open.
Okay, then we're going to go to Brother Dennis. Your mic is also open.
Good evening, everyone. Very interesting program. I just want to say that right now there's a letter penned to the United States government, to Joe Biden, to Merrick Garland, under LUI, just an update on that. And also that LUI slams the gavel on U.S. Legal system corruption. In their capacity as leaders of grassroots campaign known as Opt-In USA, LUI co-founder and CEO Belinda Parker Brown, as well as our Assistant Chief of Operations, Dr. Zena Crenshaw Logo, recently called on the Biden administration to redress the United States legal system corruption. The related June 15, 2021 press release appears online in whole or part well over a half a million times and still has phenomenal click-through rate of nearly 60%. Remember these words, absolute judicial immunity, courts are power distribution centers, and violation of canon law. That's what we go through when we go through these court systems, think that we're going in and there will be some justice, and in fact, there never is any justice. Finally, I'd like to read this to everyone, and I'm done. These people are at war over here. 17 shot in two Chicago mass shootings, including 11 in Marquette Park attack. We are constantly falling for the setup, not only in Chicago, but all over this colonizing country, a country founded on the murder and butchery of the indigenous people by the very same established slave-catching institution called the United States of America. I say this as there is a bill now being constructed from the highest level of government that will allow for stronger police policy that will have more devastating effect on the colonized people, those of us who are melanated throughout this country. Mind you, guns are brought into the black communities from the Federal Industrial Complex, COINTELPRO. And we have a tendency to use these very weapons on ourselves foolishly, which emboldens the military industrial complex to come into the community and kill us. Mind you, all drive-by shootings in the hood are not necessarily done by the victims in the hood. These shootings are strategically done by the colonizer, who make it seem in the media that it was the people in the hood shooting erratically. Don't get it twisted, people. People in the hood foolishly fall for the bait and switch, also shoot one another and receive the publicity. Yet we make no mistake about it. The colonizer shoots and kills its own as well and receives less media attention. This orchestration against us is the offset for any bill that would protect us from as of the enemy had any intention on lessening his genocide on us. We, on the other hand, must stop self-inflicted murderous crimes on one another, stop aiding and abetting the open permanent enemy on this genocidal tactics against ourselves. Never forget that we are taught to hate ourselves, and we are doing a great job of doing so while we are the most hated people on the planet that would tell you and me that these colonizing slave catchers are here to serve and protect us as they kill us daily. Uhuru.
Uhuru. Freedom.
All right. Brother Joel, your mic is open. Brother Joel.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
Okay. So phone's still working, I guess. So, anyway, I've listened to the presentations today, and they're really amazing in terms of the depth and the breadth of all of the incidents and the interconnectedness of them that is operating as the central pivot of this system of expression, imperialism, and various forms of slavery, although that word isn't a popular word that those who profit from it like to use, but that's really what the bulk of the world is subjected to right now, and especially people of color, and very intensely and intensifyingly in the United States. We can see this as a continuing thing. It hasn't ended with the end of Trump. It's just continued with more chocolate covering put on top of the really putrid substance that the system contains. I heard the thing is though that more and more, one of the reasons that Trump was even able to get in there and simulate being elected at all was because the central establishment in this country is becoming universally hated, mistrusted, or distrusted, I should say, and looked at as a bunch of crooks, as the government also was looked at as a council of different types of mafias controlling different types of our lives, which are constantly being privatized, sometimes in the name of reform and sometimes in the name of being collectivized. I want to caution people about, it's very good if you look at the aspect of it, that the government will pay medical bills that otherwise people would not be able to afford. But along with that will come the whole methodology of corporate racist modern medicine. And I say that because there's a whole history to that also. We read about witch hunts all over Europe, witch hunts in Massachusetts, and to this day we hear overtones of it. A lot of that was war against natural medicine. The so-called witches were the people who understood the various herbal remedies and different types of health and treatment programs that have been largely lost today under the blare of the pharmaceutical companies and the whole approach that they have really of fighting nature rather than going along with nature. And this is true not only in, but even more so in the psychiatric part of it, because what they, with the capital T, want to do is control our minds and give themselves authority and the medical fraud of claiming that it's all for our own good. But we can see, like I was visiting somebody in a temporarily in a mild mental place, and it was like worse than what I saw when I was in prison in terms of you can't bring anything in for the patients. You can only have very limited contact. They're not allowed to have cell phones and so on, things that would only exacerbate emotional problems that already exist. And along with the economic, the stealing of the land and everything else was also the destruction of the natural mind, along with the destruction of the natural economy. And the use of that to build the authority to present the mass murderers and the war criminals as the healers that we have to look to improve our health. And that's the intention, I think, of most medical doctors. But they're given a four-year course designed by pharmaceutical companies to brainwash them more than the rest of the population, because it's a specialized focus brainwashing. And again, all in the name of healing people. We see that a lot of the remedies are as bad or worse than the disease, and yet they go on and on. You look at the profitability of something called the cancer system. Cancer used to be a very rare disease, and now it's all over the place. And we're told that modern medicine will make all these improvements for us, but actually it's lost contact with natural healing. So, hello?
We're here. We're listening.
Well, wait a minute.
We're listening, Joel.
Joel, we're here.
Yes, I'm not mad at
you. Okay, on that note, we'll have to wait, Joel, remember to hear Joel finish
Now we've lost them. But my brothers and sisters, it has been a... Yes,
hello?
Now we have again.
I'm
sorry. We're going to end that on that. We're on over... But if you back in September, go through that again, because it is very important that we understand that which you were presenting this evening. Good night.
All right, Val Pointer, what's happening? Thank you, everybody.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.